Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Charlie Cook of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim Garrity is out for the remainder of the week, but we still have good, bad, and crazy martinis. And Charlie, we start with the good. And as some folks may be aware, more folks will be aware tomorrow, that Thursday is the official opening of the Presidential Library of George W. Bush on the campus of Southern Methodist University. The good news is that given the last 4 years or so, Americans have had a chance to reflect. And while his approval numbers still aren't great, they're much higher than they were when he left office. Right now, according to a new ABC News survey, 47% approve of Bush's time in office, 50% disapprove. That's not fantastic when you look at like Reagan and Clinton numbers. But when he left office, he had a 33% approval rating. And right around the time of the financial collapse / 2008 election, he had 24% approval and 73% disapproval. So conservatives obviously have the things they like about President Bush. They have a few issues, certainly, where they not agree with the way the president did things, like on immigration, which we'll talk about in a minute, on spending and some of these other things. But given the totality of the record, it's good to see that those numbers are evening out.
Yes, I have a complicated relationship with George W. Bush and his presidency. As you say, a lot of conservatives do. But it is good to see a little bit of perspective. Time will do that. It's always tempting when there's a new president, especially if the president comes in as Obama did just after a huge financial crash and at the height, I think, of dissatisfaction with Iraq, to presume that everything will now be fine and that the old guy going is going to make that so. Of course, now that 5 years have passed, you'll see a reappraisal both of Bush and of Obama, and that seems to be what's happening. They both have similar approval ratings. You know, my dad tells a story of being in the United States in 1967, and he was in a car, and Americans are quite quick to change their minds sometimes. And the Beatles, which was obviously Sgt. Pepper in 67, was the big thing. They said, no, it's the Mamas and the Papas now. Forget the Beatles. You know, it's the Mamas and the Papas now. Well, of course, by 1972 or whatever, 5 years later, you know, the Beatles were put in their right place and the Mamas and the Papas were put in their right place. And I think you do need time to sort these things out.
I think you're probably right, given that the current president's record has certainly been less than what most people thought it would be. That probably adds even more perspective in addition to just the advantage of time looking over what the president did. Some of his bigger decisions are still not popular. He's 43% approved, 53% disapprove on the economy, 57% still disapprove of his decision to invade Iraq, which was 65% at the time that he left office. So 84% approval among Republicans, 25% among Democrats, and 45% among independents. So pretty much how you'd expect it to break down. I don't think there's a huge clamoring for him to be back in office necessarily, but I think there is greater appreciation, certainly for some of the thornier issues that he dealt with, like the onset of the war on terror and some other issues as well. Cutting taxes, I think we all like that pretty much. And there's still some things that people just aren't going to like over time. But perhaps more people are seeing now that as President Obama continues, President Bush isn't looking quite as bad as he did before. And I think as more time goes on, people have a greater affection for him personally when they don't have to confront his policies on a day-to-day basis.
I think he will be judged a lot more kindly than he has been in the last 5 years. The legacy of President Bush will always be 9/11, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The tax, we call them the Bush tax cuts, but they're now the Obama tax cuts, or most of them are. They've been made permanent. Those things people seem to regard as being a constant feature, whereas 9/11, Afghanistan, and Iraq will be allied with President Bush in the public imagination. So it will take a little bit of time to sort all of those things out. There's also the question when it comes to this president of whether Obamacare will become this president's Iraq. And if it does, that will have far-reaching consequences, not just for next year's election and perhaps for 2016, but also for how people appraise the whole period. And I think you might see some Bush nostalgia if the healthcare system does, as Max Baucus says, become a train wreck.
And when you hear that from the guy who wrote the bill, that's
right.
Not an encouraging sign. But anyway, on to martini number two now, and immigration is the issue. And as we've seen really since the start of this latest Congress, Charlie, Marco Rubio has been one of the most ardent advocates for this bipartisan reform. And now that we're starting to learn more of the details, including pet projects, loopholes in terms of border security. He's still ardently behind it, which is frustrating a lot of conservatives. And the same is going on in the House, even though there's not an official House version of this bill yet. Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, giving a speech before a highly Democratic audience in Chicago. Here's just a couple of clips from that address earlier this week, and it kind of sets the table for why this could be a very troubling time for conservatives.
And it's because people like Luis Gutierrez and Paul Ryan and everybody in between are talking to each other in a sincere way to come together, to find common ground, to once and for all get this done. We need to enforce our laws. We need to have laws that we can enforce. That's very important.
And so, Charlie, I think that the quick conservative response to that would be, first of all, if you're in close negotiations with Luis Gutierrez, the most ardent supporter of amnesty, chances are most conservative principles aren't going to be adhered to here. And I think the strongest conservative argument is that we haven't tried to enforce a lot of our border laws. Maybe we should do that before we throw out everything that's currently on the books. And I think what got a lot of eyebrows up this week is when Paul Ryan basically said the immigration issues related to the suspected bombers in Boston shouldn't be a factor in this debate. I think that scared a lot of people.
Your first point is spot on. If you look at the bill that has come out of the Gang of Eight in the Senate, it is not one that is particularly favorable toward Republicans. The Democrats have said very openly, we can't believe how many concessions are in it. I am an immigrant, as you can hear from my voice, so I understand the need to address this. I think it becomes difficult for conservatives. You know, you say the conservative approach. This is pretty much a civil war. In the libertarian side seems to be far more in favor of open borders. Then there's the rule of law types like myself, possibly bolstered by the fact that I went through the system. Then you have those who say, well, firstly, why aren't we enforcing the border? And who ask Marco Rubio, why do you expect us to believe that we will deport people strictly based on the criteria that you keep selling us, but we won't deport anybody now? And then you have a Grover Norquist, for example, who generally is the sort of conservative champion on things like taxes, but seems to be on the other side. Two of the big stars, young stars in the Republican Party, agree with him, Rubio and Ryan. There is very possibly a revolt coming against the bill. I think it may be a sort of quiet revolt at the moment, but it wouldn't surprise me if this got killed. It's very, very difficult to see what the, if you call it, conservative line on this bill is.
Are you saying coming from the Senate, coming from the House, once it clears the Senate? What's your sense on that?
Well, I think a lot of conservatives and Republicans thought after 2012 that they had to do this. They had to hold their nose and just do it, whether they hated it or loved it, because if they didn't, then the Republican Party would be doomed. That was the conventional wisdom. I feel as if there's been some pushback on that. The nature of the bill, for example, the projections as to what this would do to the Republican and Democratic parties, respectively. And yet the opposition to it has been quite quiet. They've let Marco Rubio go out there. They've let Paul Ryan go and sell this. I wouldn't be surprised if this went a little bit like the gun bill. And when it actually came to it, they suddenly realized that there are an awful lot of people who were against it. I really don't know how to call it, but I feel as if there's a real silent opposition to what's happening in Congress and the way that it's being done that is about to rear its head.
On to the third and crazy martini. And Charlie, I don't think I have to remind anybody how awful last week was with all the different stories of the Boston Marathon bombing, the fertilizer plant explosion in Texas, and the ricin scare and the letters that were tested and shown to be positive for the deadly poison sent to President Obama and Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker. But the good news last week, pretty much the only good news we had on a major story other than the apprehension of the bomber, was that we thought we had the suspect in custody in lightning quick fashion in terms of we had this Paul Kevin Curtis. The feds announced his arrest. It looked like it was a case of pretty shoddy attempt to cover his own tracks. And now it turns out he might have been set up because the feds have dropped the charges. They found no trace of ricin in his home. They've now searched the home of this guy, Everett Duchke, who also lives in Tupelo. Apparently those two have feuded, so the first guy thought maybe this other guy set him up some way. No charges filed against either one at this point, which leads a lot of people to believe we might be back at square one here, which is terrible. If Curtis is innocent, obviously that's good that we're not prosecuting an innocent man, but it doesn't look like we're wrapping this up as neatly as we hoped last week.
No, wrapping it up neatly. This is a bizarre story. This is sort of a John Grisham novel that's performed by Saturday Night Live. He fits the bill of a joke almost pretty well. He has three names. That's sort of all evil people are supposed to. Paul, Kevin, Curtis. All three first names is the prerequisite in America for anyone who's going to kill anyone or do anything stupid. He's an Elvis impersonator. He's obviously, and this by no means means he's guilty. He seems not to be. But he seems to be something of a crank. And yet we find that someone might be setting up the Mississippi Elvis impersonator with three names because of a family feud. My favorite quote on this came from Paul Kevin Curtis, the Mississippi Elvis impersonator. He said that he was anxious to get back to normal. God knows what that looks like. No, I suppose the downside of this is that we're back to square one, but I think I would speak for everyone in the country when I say that it is much better to have no leads than it is to imprison somebody wrongly.
Well, that's certainly true, and I've never been the target, nor have I targeted a vendetta against anyone. Charlie, I don't know if you have or not. This seems pretty extreme if you're going to try and set somebody up over some sort of dispute between yourselves personally.
Yes, I've never really been tempted to set anyone up, but I can assure you that if I were tempted to set anyone up, I wouldn't try and kill the President of the United States in the process of doing it. I mean, this could have gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Right.
Ricin is an absolutely disgusting substance. So I do hope we catch whoever did it. But it is one of those stories that you think has been made up.
Well, yeah, even when we thought we knew what happened last week, it sounded crazy enough. So who knows what the actual story is going to end up being. But the ricin.
It's just so bizarre that it came after the Boston. I mean, it seems as if when there is a terrorist attack in the United States, there's also a ricin scare or an anthrax scare, male poison, as if that's some sort of hard and fast rule with which we now live.
Charlie, it's a crazy world we live in, and you're a brave man for helping me try to figure it out. So appreciate
my pleasure.
Appreciate your time today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you. Bye-bye then.
Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today and throughout the rest of the week. I am Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Charlie and me on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.